Karen Armstrong is a one-woman publishing industry, the author of nearly 20 books on religion. When her breakthrough book, A History of God, appeared in 1993, she quickly became one of the world's leading historians of spiritual matters. Her work displays a wide-ranging knowledge of religious traditions, from the monotheistic religions to Buddhism. That expertise is on full display in her latest book. Titled The Great Transformation, it charts the origins of many of the world's religions, including Confucianism, Taoism, Buddhism, Hinduism, and Judaism. What's remarkable is that all these spiritual traditions emerged in the same historical era, the Axial Age, from 900 to 200 BC. As Karen Armstrong told Steve Paulson, they were all responding to the rampant violence of their time.
It was one of the great interesting discoveries to me. I couldn't believe it when I was researching this against the backdrop of our own time, when religion is often used to justify atrocious acts, that in every single case the catalyst for religious change had been a revulsion, a disciplined turning away from violence.
So what was the message, what was the spiritual message that rejected violence?
First of all, they all insisted in very different ways, but they came to the same conclusion, that you must give up and abandon your ego, that the cause of violence, hatred, and human evil is very largely rooted in desperation about the ego. We are egocentric creatures, and so the sages said that the root cause of suffering lay in our desperate concern with self, which often needs to destroy others in order to preserve itself. Mm. And so they insisted that if we stepped outside the ego, then we would encounter what we call Brahman or God, Nirvana or the Tao.
And you say this was one of the common messages in all these religions was what we now call the Golden Rule. And it was really Confucius who was probably the first person who came up with this idea.
All these sages, with the exception of the Greeks, posited a different sort of a counter-ideology to the violence of their time. And the safest way to get rid of egotism was by means of compassion. When you dethrone yourself from the center of your world and put another person there. And so the first person to promulgate the Golden Rule, which was the bedrock of this compassionate, empathic spirituality, was Confucius, 500 years before Christ. Mm. Do not do to others as you would not have done to you. His disciples asked him, what is the single thread that runs through all your teaching and pulls it all together? And Confucius said, look into your own heart, discover what it is that gives you pain, and then refuse under any circumstances whatsoever to inflict that pain on anybody else. The Buddha had his version of the Golden Rule. Jesus taught it. And Rabbi Hillel, the older contemporary of Jesus, said that the Golden Rule was the essence of Judaism.
Now, do you see parallels between what happened 2,500 years ago and what's happening in the world today?
Well, yes, we too are living in a very, very violent period when the world is changing radically, where we have no idea where we're going, where we seem to be on the brink of destroying one another. And the Axial Sages had that very, very strong feeling too as life took these dangerous turnings, steps forward.
Now, there is the question of whether all of these religions you've been talking about were actually religions. I mean, the ancient Greeks, certainly Socrates and Plato, where, I mean, their philosophies were not religious at all. Buddhism, in a way, is essentially a philosophy of mind. Confucianism, I suppose you could see it as essentially a system of ethics.
That's a very chauvinistic Western view, if I may say so. You know, you're saying this is what we regard as religion, and anything that doesn't measure up to that isn't. I think a Buddhist or a Confucian would be very offended to hear that he or she was not practicing a religion.
Well, explain that then.
Well,
what is religion then?
Religion is a search for transcendence. But transcendence isn't necessarily cited in an external god, which can be a very unspiritual, unreligious concept. The sages were all extremely concerned with transcendence, with going beyond the self and discovering a realm, a reality that could not be defined in words. Nirvana. Buddhists talk about nirvana in very much the same terms as monotheists describe God.
It's so hard today to wrap our heads around that Buddhism, which is essentially non-theistic, that notion of nirvana is essentially the same, or the message is the same. The experience of
it is the same.
The Christian God.
And the trouble is that we define our God too closely. We say God is the supreme being. Well, in my book about God, written some years ago, A History of God, I pointed out that the most eminent Jewish, Christian and Muslim theologians all said that you couldn't think about God as a simple personality, an external being. It was better to say that God did not exist, because our notion of existence was far too limited to apply to God.
Didn't a lot of people say God was beyond language? I mean, we could only get the sort of experience, the glimmers of the afterglow of
and
God.
And that's simply what the Buddha is saying. You can't define nirvana. You can't say what it is. You can just get intimations of it by the practice of compassion and by the systematic extirpation of egotism. He was once asked by a Brahmin priest who passed him in contemplation and was absolutely mesmerized by the picture of this man sitting with utter serenity, utter concentration, and he had a great sense of power reined in. And he said to him, "Are you a god, sir? Are you an angel or a spirit?" And the Buddha said, "No." He said, "I'm awake." That his disciplined lifestyle had, as it were, activated parts of his humanity that ordinarily lie dormant.
So you're saying that these ancient sages really didn't care about big metaphysical systems. They didn't care about theology.
No, none of them did. And indeed, neither did Jesus. Jesus did not spend a great deal of time discoursing about the Trinity or original sin or the incarnation or the atonement, which have preoccupied later Christians. He went around doing good, being compassionate, practicing the axial age spirituality of Jian Ai, as the Chinese called it, concern for everybody, even people who were left regarded with disdain by the establishment. And in the Quran, metaphysical speculation is regarded as self-indulgent guesswork, zanna. And it makes people, the Quran says, quarrelsome and stupidly sectarian. You can't prove these things one way or the other, so why quarrel about it? I think sometimes the way monotheists talk about God is unreligious.
Unreligious, like the personal God, for instance?
Yes, because people very often talk about him as though he's a kind of acquaintance whom they can second guess. People will say, God loves that, God wills that, and God despises the other. And very often the opinions of the deity are made to coincide exactly with those of the speaker.
And yet we certainly see talk of a personal God in various sacred texts. Aren't just making that up.
No, but the great theologians in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam say, yes, you begin with the idea of a God who is personal. But God transcends personality as God transcends every other human characteristic, such as gender. You know, very often people hear about God at about the same time as they're learning about Santa Claus. Mm-hmm. But their ideas of Santa Claus mature and change in time, but their idea of God remains infantile.
What about the supernatural, though? I mean, do you need any sense of the miraculous or of, things that cannot be explained by science, by this world?
I think religions hold us in an attitude of awe and wonder. People such as the Buddha thought miracles were rather vulgar, displays of power that often displays of ego. And I think we need to look carefully at the miracles attributed to Jesus, the healing miracles, they generally had some kind of symbolic aspect about healing the soul rather than showily showing off a supernatural power, because that can be an exercise in egotism too.
Well, it does raise the question, though, of how to read the sacred scriptures.
Indeed.
And because there are all kinds of inflammatory things that are said there. I mean, there are, for instance, many passages in both the Bible and the Quran that exhort the faithful to kill the infidels. And Sam Harris, in his book The End of Faith, has, I think, seven very densely packed pages of nothing but quotations from the Quran with just this message: God's curse be upon the infidels, slay them wherever you find them, fighting is obligatory for you, much as you dislike it. And Sam Harris's point is that the Muslim suicide bombings are not the aberration of Islam. They are the message of Islam.
Well, that's simply not true. I mean, you know, he's taken parts of those texts and omitted their conclusions, which says fighting is hateful for you and you have to do it if you're attacked, as Muhammad was being attacked at the time when that verse was revealed. But forgiveness is better for you, it always ends. Peace is better. But to isolate these texts as though they were expressed the whole of the tradition is very mischievous and dangerous at this time when we are in danger of polarizing other people. This kind of inflammatory talk, say, about Islam, is convincing Muslims all over the world who are not extremists that the West is incurably Islamophobic. Mm-hmm. And will never respect their traditions.
But yet, on the other hand, you talk to some of these people who would say, well, you know, it's not, you can't really just pick out the peaceful and loving passages of the sacred scriptures because there are plenty of other passages in there that
I would say there are more passages in the Bible than the Quran that are dedicated to violence. And I think what we all ought to do, religious people, in this day and age, is to look at our own sacred traditions, our own. Not just pointing a finger at somebody else's, but our own. Christians should look hard and long at the Book of Revelation. And they should look at those passages in the Pentateuch that speak of the destruction of the enemy. It is not enough to point an accusing finger at another faith when our own tradition, and indeed our own secularists, let's not forget that in its short history, secularism has had some catastrophes.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly most of the tragedies of the 20th century were committed by secularists. Stalin, Hitler.
Hitler, Saddam Hussein, another question in point, a secularist supported by us in the West initially for 10 years. Even when he gassed the Kurds, we supported him because he was a secularist. And if people are resistant to secularism in Iraq now, it's because their most recent experience of it was Saddam. So I think this kind of chauvinism that says science is right, religion is wrong, or secularism is right, religion is all bomb, this is one-sided and I think basically egotistic.
Well, it seems to me that you're saying also that to be religious, to really be religious, is tremendously hard work.
Yes.
I mean, it's far harder than just
singing a few hymns.
Well, or just reading the scriptures and just trying to literally read these and take the messages and apply them to your life. I mean, you can't live that way.
Basically, religion is hard work. It's an art form. It's a way of finding meaning, like painting, like music, like poetry, in a world that is violent and cruel and often seems meaningless. Religion is like any other activity. It's like art or cooking or sex or science. You have good art, sex and science, and bad art, sex and science. It's not always easy to do it well.